This is The Conversation. It's episode 177 with Matt Gonzalez. He is a San Francisco-based artist. Yeah, I told you, if you listened last week, it's San Francisco month on The Conversation. He is also not just an artist, he is chief attorney in the Public Defender Office of San Francisco and former Green Party mayoral and vice presidential candidate. Much more than just art is in store. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see, of course, images of Matt's collage work, as well as a couple of shots of him with Ralph Nader, a shot of a car plastered with Matt Gonzalez posters, which is pretty cool, him at work, in process, and so on. So go check those out at the website. As you've been listening, you've noticed that I have not ramped up much in the way of political dialogue, monologuing on the show, but I have made allusions, subtle allusions. And funny enough, with Matt, while we do talk about politics inevitably, because that's what he did for a while, we don't talk specifically about what's going on right now. So only in an outside sort of way, as you will hear. It has to do with the upcoming trial of Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, who Matt is representing, and you'll hear about that towards the latter part of the conversation, just FYI. All right, stick around on the back end for the usual. And in the meantime, before we get to the conversation with Matt, I did read something recently that I pricked up my ears a little bit, and I thought you might be interested if you haven't seen it as well. Every once in a while, there's an intriguing profile in The New Yorker that is an artist profile, and this one was of young artist Brad Trommel. He has been represented by Foyer Meisler. Lauren Marinaro, former guest of the show, was the director when we spoke. I think she's got her own project now. In any case, I like what the piece alludes to at the very beginning. If you just look at the caption of the picture right at the start of the article, Trommel finds the gallery system too slow, too insular, and too full of gatekeepers. To which I say, bravo, let's make a podcast about that. But as you may see as you read the whole piece, it's not quite as simple as that. And it doesn't maybe necessarily go where you anticipate it will go in the form of the artist being profiled. But nonetheless, it is thought-provoking. So go check it out if you haven't already. All right, let's get to that conversation with Matt Gonzalez. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. More on the back end. I will talk to you then. You're being a longtime San Francisco, and you're actually in Texas at the moment. Are you in or near your hometown, by the way?
Yeah, I'm in my hometown, the town I was born in.
Okay, and what's the name of that town?
It's called McAllen, McAllen.
Mm-hmm. And what is the nearest city?
Well, it's south of San Antonio, straight down 250 miles south, and then it's north of the Mexican border by about 10 miles from Reynosa, Mexico.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it is, it's fairly remote area, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when I was born here, there was probably about, I don't know, 25, 30,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's considered a bit of a metropolis, you know.
No kidding.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's probably, the area is starting to eat up little towns, and it's probably a couple hundred thousand in the area.
Wow. And is it described as a large exurban area, perhaps?
I don't know how it's described, and I realize in even putting that number out there, I could be really inaccurate.
Right.
I mean, I left here when I was 18, and I'm 51 now, so...
Right. So being there now, or when you do go back, do you get nostalgic for the simpler version of that town?
Well, yeah, for sure.
I mean,
you know, some of the streets that were just two-lane streets are now four or five streets, so a lot of the
markers
I don't recognize them. They're little commercial districts in places that were just orange groves, you know,
wow.
Grapefruit groves.
Right.
But you know, I know, I still have friends here, and there's a little community of artists that I try to see whenever I come here. So
that's nice. Yeah, that's great. And we should say, even though you're not, as you would have been if you weren't down there, you would be at your public defender's office when we were having this conversation, presumably. But the question comes to mind, if when you were at the height of your sort of political recognition, you can tell me whenever that was, if when you went down there, if you were seen as sort of a celebrity political figure of any kind.
You know, I wasn't at all, mm-hmm. although there were kids I remember growing up with who, at the time I was holding political office in San Francisco on the Board of Supervisors, mm-hmm. that were the counterparts here, you know, on the city council. One of them became a mayor of this town, and
mm-hmm.
you know, a kid I played football with was on the city council, stuff like that. So,
right.
You know, it was amusing to watch as a spectator.
And what is the hometown, how would you describe the temperature of your hometown politically?
Well, you know, it's traditionally been a very Democratic-leaning area because it's very high Mexican-American population.
Mm-hmm.
Although, candidly, since I've been here, I've run into more people that voted for Trump than for Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't run into anybody that voted for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein.
Right, right.
The only Clinton voters have been two young women, you know, mm-hmm. college-age women. And when they spoke about it, you know, they almost were apologizing or getting prepared to, you know, they didn't know my politics, so they were kind of like backpedaling as they explained why they voted for her.
That's interesting. So you come off as a unrecognizable, you know, if people don't know who you are, you come off as unrecognizable or even potentially Republican, at least you did to these two women?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they just make the assumption that everybody voted for him because he won
right.
pretty convincingly here. I mean, right. you know, my friends know my politics, so
yeah,
they're not surprised that I, you know, repudiate Trump or anything like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have been actually quite surprised that pretty left-leaning people that voted even for Bernie Sanders ended up voting for Trump.
Wow. Well, that's a whole nother conversation that we could get into some other day.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out the fact that regardless of the relatively left-leaning politics of your hometown, from what it seems, the culture of Texas in terms of its really severe laws around a lot of things and maybe limited civil rights in some cases, even compared to where you have spent your adult life, San Francisco. I mean, that extreme, something that you at some point you must have experienced whiplash going from one to the other.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think one of the things that made it possible for me, though, to talk with what we would call, you know, conservative politicians or people in San Francisco is that I had this experience of growing up with people that were, you know, dear friends of mine who didn't share my political views. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, you learn how to talk with people in a way that isn't, it doesn't devolve to name calling or anything like that. And
right.
I've done pretty well with people here. When I get into a lengthy conversation, you appeal to their libertarian values if they're conservative, and oftentimes, you know, after a relatively short conversation, they're fundamentally in agreement for more of the civil rights kind of stuff that we believe in, but you know, in San Francisco. But it does take a little effort.
Yeah. I imagine that your equanimity, your calm, that is presumably a very consistent part of your demeanor. Correct me if I'm wrong. Has served you well in these kinds of conversations?
I think that's probably true. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't of that demeanor is something chosen as much as just kind of, you know, the way you turn out or
mm-hmm.
experience takes you to that place, but. Yeah, I think it's helpful. I mean, I think any time someone is being honest with you and they have honestly held views, even if you adamantly disagree, it's at least a starting point, you know?
Yeah.
The harder part is when people articulate political views or political decision-making and they're motivated by, let's say, profit motive or some special interest, you know, giving some kind of benefit or favor, because then it's illogical. You can't get underneath it or truly understand it unless you know that relationship, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, as much as I still want to get into your political career and, you know, various important moments, since you are an artist as well, and this is an art podcast, I feel like we should, for listeners' sake, if not for mine, get into your being an artist. So when was it that you first started making art regularly?
You know, I first really started doing it in late 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And I had experimented a little bit with painting. And, you know, my idea was to just better understand what I was looking at when I looked at artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to push paint around and try to figure out, you know, what it took to do it. And, you know, the works I made were fairly derivative of the things I was looking at, you know, geometric abstraction or very simplistic figurative work in the vein of, you know, Bay Area figuration or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But very quickly I got into collage work as I combined found elements with some of the paintings I was doing on paper, you know, kind of ripped those up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it was around 2005, and in 2006, I really went at it, and the work was very spontaneous, so I made it quickly, and I made a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when I look back at some of it now, some of it I think is really not very, very good. But every now and then I run across a piece that I'm just astounded at the spontaneity achieving something that I wouldn't be able to do today if I tried, you know?
Right.
Something naive and fresh about the approach.
But since you went to school for law, where was it that you were getting, where did your exposure to contemporary art come from? Was there any exposure as you were growing up? Did it not happen until you were in San Francisco? And was it through friends? I mean, I presume it wasn't through your law colleagues that you were being introduced to contemporary art.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I there was a museum growing up, but it was basically one of these, you know, science kind of teaching kind of museums with crafts and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dinosaur footprints and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't until I went to college in New York City where, you know, I was, you know, and required to take a class in art history.
Mm-hmm.
And I started really looking at things and having to try to write about them. And so that's where it sort of opened up for me.
Right. Okay. So this was undergrad in New York?
Right. I was at Columbia on the upper West Side, and, you know, the museums are so phenomenal there.
Yeah.
So I remember seeing shows, you know, on the Dutch painters and Baltus and just all these great, you know, things that I'd never even thought of. I mean, I didn't know they existed.
Right.
I mean, I remember being at a party. And I must have been 17 or 18, and a friend of mine was telling me who Van Gogh was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have like this memory of somebody was trying to tell me about this artist they had discovered or learned about.
Right.
That's how out of touch we were, really.
So it was being the art was sort of gradually seeping into your system as you know, you were continuing on with law and whatnot, and then how did it come back to that point in 2005-06 where you actually said, you know, I'm gonna try this?
Well, I think, you know, I kind of came into it as a art buyer, collector, patron, you know, whatever
right.
you want to call it,
right?
And I had a lot of artist friends who, you know, I think I realized early on that for whatever cultural reason designation, you know, working as a lawyer was more valued in our society monetarily,
mm-hmm.
and that's somewhat contrived,
mm-hmm.
but it gave me resources to be able to, you know, buy a painting for $300 or $400 and not have to think that hard about it. And in the process of meeting artists and going to their studios, you know, I'd have conversations with them about where inspiration came from or how do you know artwork is finished. And, you know, I just was welcomed by those artists to comment on the art, and I just slowly learned. And in that process somewhere, I must have just... I wanted to give it a go just to try to understand some of these things for myself.
Right. And from the time that you started messing around with the paint, as you described earlier, to the collage form that you, collage style that you use now, could you say about how long that was?
Yeah, well, my whole art-making time has probably been about 12 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 2 or 3 years ago, I took a trip to Ireland on a rather remote island called Bear Island. You got to take a ferry to get to this island. And I spent 3 weeks there with a friend whose family is from there, and he has a house there. And I took some collage material with me, some paper with me, thinking that I might have difficulty getting my scraps there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I probably made about 5 collages while I was there, but because I had so much time on my hands, you know, if I wasn't at the pub or taking a hike, there was nothing to do. And you could only drink so much, you know. And
uh-huh.
And the island was pretty small. I mean, I think I hiked every part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I started putting more and more time into each individual work because I didn't really have the materials to start a fresh collage. And so the work became more dense, more sort of built up, had a kind of sculptural element to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I liked that I hadn't pushed myself far enough. And instead of putting 1 or 2 or 3 hours into a piece, I was now putting 15 hours into one or 10,
right.
12 hours.
Right.
And, yeah, you get obviously something very different.
So the mature Matt Gonzalez of your work came like about 3 years ago on this, the evolution of your work over this trip, it sounds like, right?
Yeah. I would say that.
So in other words, you've had about 12 years of art making and about 9, you reach your mature style. And I guess all that's all sort of minutia, but I guess the point that I'm trying to get to is it's a fast trajectory for art making. And I wonder, one would suspect that, you know, having lived a life, regardless of what field it was in, even if it's in sort of, as some would describe it, a rather counter field, you know, law versus art, that just having lived life, that somehow that made your art maturing process that much faster? Is that the way you see it?
It's interesting. I guess I don't, you know, when you don't know that your work is going to develop or change,
mm-hmm.
I think you're not all that conscious of that you're on a path somewhere. You think you're just thinking about the present.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the present had a lot to do. It was almost like a little meditation. You know, I would disappear to collage for a little while, and you know, it became a daily thing that I did, and it might, you know, deviate in terms of the amount of time I could devote to it, but that little meditation, rather than it being a walk or, let's say, a meditation in a monastery or something,
mm-hmm.
this one had a little artifact at the end of it. And, you know, differing degrees of quality depending on what the materials were that I was working with.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I was encouraged to keep doing it because some of my artist friends would roll in and they'd say, hey, that's really cool. Can I trade you a drawing for that or
mm-hmm.
this or that?
Right.
So the progress happens, but you realize, you know, it looks like you're making a choice to change your work, But it just evolves. I mean, I'm sure you know this. It just evolves. And sometimes I look at that older work and I'm like, God, I don't even know how I would start to make that. It's just so different, you know?
Right, yeah. It sounds like from what you just said that you had a smooth sort of transition from, you know, collector of artists and, you know, and supporter of artists to an artist yourself. I can't help but wonder if being seen as a collector, a patron, and then going to being an artist amongst your peers as artists, if there was some, you know, skepticism from people who had been doing it much longer and that kind of thing. I kind of, my suspicion is that you didn't really get that, but why don't you tell me what actually happened?
Well, I mean, I think typically there's always going to be some skepticism or pushback when you start doing something that you're not particularly known for.
Right.
Particularly if you are taking it serious and doing a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure some people scratched their head. They were perfectly polite to me, and so I don't have any insults to share. But
right.
But I do think that I do like the idea that I think we would all benefit from trying more things that we start out not being good at.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like everything, if you do enough of it, you really do become, you know, it's like the Malcolm Gladwell or whatever idea. You become an
right.
expert over a certain amount of hours
right.
put into something. And for my own self, I like the idea that this art-making thing wasn't something that couldn't be democratized, that couldn't be spread around where everybody could get something, even if they're not going to produce a work of art that's going to be sold in a gallery, that there might be a benefit to it. And so I've enjoyed making art over the years with, you know, total beginners to people that are, you know, exhibited painters, et cetera. You know, it's fun. It gives you a little insight on the creative process and how people's brains work. You know, it's a little problem they're trying to solve.
Right.
And for the painters that I've collaged with, they often come away from a session of, you know, 2 or 3 hours with real respect for the medium. You know, they suddenly are saying things like, God, I didn't realize it was this hard, or, you know, it's kind of hard to get this thing that, you know, because they're so conversant with oil or brush that they can do it, they know how to do it, and suddenly they're in a different medium. And, you know, there's a greater respect as a result of it.
It sounds like you're describing, and I kind of missed the transition into it, but you've been having sessions over the years with fellow artists. So you invite them to your studio and you sit down and you make your thing and you sort of invite them to use your materials and do their version. Is that what it's like?
Yeah, it's a little, yeah, it's some of that. Sometimes they bring their own materials. Mm-hmm. I've worked in other artists' studios. Painter Gustavo Rivera, a good friend of mine, who's in his mid-70s. He's been working in San Francisco for, you know, 40-plus years.
Mm-hmm.
The oil painter, but he does collage as well and wood sculpture. And I was good friends with one of the Bay Area figurative painters, William Theophilus Brown, and also Paul Warner. But with Bill Brown, I would go to his studio on California Street and, you know, we had a little routine. We'd get together once a week and make artwork for a couple hours, drink a little scotch or whiskey, and then, you know, go drink some wine and some oysters and, you know, eat some oysters and just kind of, you know, it was a very pleasurable way to keep the motivation going.
Mm-hmm.
To not call your session off early, you know, because mm-hmm. someone else is doing it as well.
Yeah. Sounds very civilized. So working,
I know it sounds almost aristocratic, but yeah,
it's civilized in a good way.
Yeah.
But as it were, being a public defender of San Francisco that you are, and presumably when you've been working there, that's full time essentially, and when you were in politics, that was probably more than full time. So where has the time to make? Is that an evening and weekend kind of thing, or what's the schedule?
Yeah, that tends to be the case. But in some ways, because of the nature of the materials and the working with the hands with small shards of paper, you know, my hands can only take so many hours of it in any event. So,
right.
You know, if I didn't have a job, so to speak, I probably wouldn't be collaging all that more.
Mm-hmm.
I might do a better job of gathering materials, you know, probably go on more walks and harvest, you know, the found material I work with.
Right.
But I find plenty of time to make work. I don't have a television at home, and, you know, I think I'm pretty good at escaping, you know, distractions when I want to get some work done. And as I said, you know, it's a really nice kind of mental clarity that results from it. And even if I'm not working on a legal case, I've certainly gotten ideas about things I'm writing or about problems I'm solving in a courtroom while I'm collaging. So, you know, your brain goes to different places, and it's kind of like you go to sleep and you wake up and you remember the thing you couldn't when you went to sleep. You know?
Right.
Your brain keeps working.
Well, you anticipated what I was thinking about, which is if you're listening to anything, it sounds like, do you prefer silence when you're making these things?
Well, no, I mean, I listen to music. I can have a conversation with someone. I mean, I don't want to sit in collage and talk about a complex legal problem or something like that with another person, but certainly conversation. And, I tell you, one of the things that's most fascinating about collaging with someone is that, you know, you don't think about it, but in the normal course of interacting with somebody, whether it's over a meal or a drink or something, your conversation can run aground ultimately because there are silences that feel a little bit awkward and maybe you're done and okay, see you next time. But with collage, you hit those silences and they can last a long time before the conversation picks up again.
Right.
And it's an odd feeling, but you feel like you spent, you know, a lot of time with someone, even if your conversation isn't any longer than it would have been over a lunch, you know?
Huh. You know, it's interesting, the group or paired collaging that you're talking about as far as art making, because the only dual or group art making that I can think of in that way tends to be studio assistants, you know, who are helping big artists, you know, on big projects.
Right.
Certainly in the art capitals, and, you know, San Francisco might not quite be that, but I would imagine it's pretty limited there as well. And maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, you don't really hear about that kind of thing. And I wonder if, do you have an awareness of artists working, you know, having jam sessions, if you will, in other parts of the country or world for that matter?
I'm not tuned into it. I'm trying to think. There's the, you know, I mean, I've certainly collaged with artists in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was a session with an artist named Albert Herder and also Raha Reznia, both of them who are showing in galleries in New York. But Albert and I were, quote-unquote, among the founders of a thing we called the San Francisco Collage Collective in, like, 2006. He ended up in New York, and so when I go out there, we always get a group together just to play around. But, you know, it's a really loose-knit group. I mean, we're not, you know, there's nothing formal about you're a member of the group or not. It's just, hey, you know, it's a good way to pass time and try to make something. The last time I was in New York, he was actually doing something quite interesting. He was using a scanner to make collage work. So he would cut the paper, place it down on the scanner, and then take a picture of it once he had, you know, put enough pieces down. And then, of course, that would be the original because he'd pick up the loose pieces and that didn't exist anymore.
Right.
So there's a lot of experimentation and play and fun.
Where do you get your materials? So it sounds like from what you've described that you're just collecting recyclable cardboardish type scraps, or what specifically are they? Because they look pretty consistent in material.
Yeah, you know, it's a little thinner than cardboard, but it isn't newsprint or magazine paper, so it's kind of It's kind of like what you get off of a cigarette carton or something you would get, an envelope or even an invite to an art show.
Right.
So I will sometimes, usually I would say, pick it up off the street, kind of discarded, or I'll pick it up from visiting, let's say, you know, I'm in an office right now and I see some paper that I want, so I'll probably just take it with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't buy it, but I don't go to the store to buy paper, but, you know, I could. I don't have, like, some rule against it. I just find plenty of stuff around, and I think the distressed paper that's been used as opposed to, you know, brand new has, I don't know, it just has a wonderful quality that you really can't artificially reproduce, or certainly not easily.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And some of those little nuances that only, you know, shoes on a sidewalk or a car running over something can accomplish, I think.
Yeah. The work, I think one could safely describe as is formal in a certain way. And I bring that up because doing, you know, law work, public defender work, paired with the making of formal art objects, I wonder if it's you've thought about the last thing you want to do in your art making is have it have, you know, social and political content, you know, that you want it to, that process to be kind of an escape, or if, you know, if those kinds of things have come up, or if it's just more like, you know, you started with painting because that was something that you were interested in, it evolved into collage, and you know, it's there's been no need to import the outside world into the work.
Yeah, I think that's a interesting question to pose and kind of kick around. I mean, I do think that you know, I've always thought that it's very difficult to do an expressly political work. I think most just straight-on political art,
mm-hmm. didactic
isn't
art,
very successful, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't hold up over time,
mm-hmm.
or the very rare pieces do. For me, it ends up, you know, to the extent that anyone could say there's a political thing happening, there is something about the materials being used and.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm working with paper that is usually presented to sell somebody a product. You know, it's whether it's a Pepsi Cola can or trash bags or a chocolate bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and it's competing against other products, so it has this inherent kind of consumerism and capitalism in it, where you get the product in part, you don't think about it, but it's in part because the wrapping is festive, or the wrapping is interesting to you, and the colors work for you, or whatever the message is on the outside. And of course, as soon as you open it up and you get the product out, that other thing gets tossed away.
Right.
And so, you know, there's something there. There's something about where we are at this particular moment in history, that this is how we buy and sell goods. I think it's interesting that, you know, we probably at some time will not have paper anymore. You know, that the idea that you need a ticket to get on a bus or, you know, the chocolate wrapper or whatever, or the movie stub. I mean, those things are kind of coming to an end slowly, but they're happening.
Sure.
So I think when somebody looks at an old Kurt Schwitters or Hannah Hock collage, they're going to have such a odd relationship to it, because someone's going to have to explain to them, oh yeah, this piece was what you would get after you boarded the train, and this allowed you to get on the next train, or, you know, whatever the explanation is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's always an interesting question whether or not somebody engaged in social, you know, activism or political work, whether or not, you know, that's explicit in the art making.
Yeah, I want to ask you about why you think political-oriented work tends not to hold up. But first, just to go back to the paper, it is true, of course, that we're moving more towards, we're moving pretty rapidly towards a paper free interactional world. However, as I was picturing you walking around San Francisco finding these colorful scraps from a lot of times food packaging and presumably cigarette packaging, it's hard to imagine when that is going to go away. You know, I mean, you do have like the bulk bins. This has actually come up in my life recently because I know somebody who's studying urban sustainability, and one of the challenges is, you know, how do you have less packaging, you know, like food packaging in your life, you know, and that's kind of a huge problem. And there are the bulk bins, you know, at co-ops and healthier food stores, but ultimately there's so many things, you know, you have to keep things fresh for long periods. There's no way around it, kind of. So that problem seems like it's going to be sticky for a while.
I see the point, but I guess I'm willing to surrender the idea that we can't conjure up what the next thing is exactly going to look like.
Right.
But already some food products and what have you are wrapped in, you know, some kind of weird plasticky stuff that it takes me a moment to be able to figure out if it's paper or not.
You know?
Some kind of hybrid thing.
Right. Right. Do you know if it's biodegradable or if it's the worst kind of plastic?
Boy, I don't know, but I assume it's not.
Yeah. All right. So why do you think, everybody certainly has their own opinion, but probably a lot fairly similar about why, let's say, political art or really didactic work tends not to hold up very well. What's your thoughts on that, particularly as somebody who has been in politics itself?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think about it as we talk. You know, there's certainly, I'm an old fan of a lot of the old Spanish Civil War posters and, you know, some of that direct, just bold messaging, you know, does hold up for me over time. But I just think it's the rare instance that it's able to do that.
Right.
Somehow you know, it's just kind of hitting you over the head sometimes. And you almost need a greater subtlety of message for it to be interesting to continue to look at over time. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of like, it's almost like it's too resolved. And I think sometimes the best works of art are the ones that feel, not, I wouldn't say unfinished, but there is a element in them that allows you to, I don't know, participate in, you know, how they're finished or see them in different ways. And I just think that that's hard to accomplish with a political piece. I mean, I'm not saying it's never done. I certainly see things that I like, but I have collage with people who, you know, decide to put just a direct message in the piece, and it's almost always ruined as a result of that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that's just the way you said that. You didn't even use a tone. You didn't need to use a tone. It sounded like, why are you going to do that?
exactly.
Right. Well, I'm trying to figure out how I want to transition back into your political life. I feel like we should maybe start with just San Francisco. 'Cause one of the things that I wanted to bring up one way or another is just, I wonder if being in a city that has such extremes, you know, because even though, and correct me if you think I'm at all wrong, but even though the city has transformed so intensely, particularly in the last 5 or 10 years, as I've talked about with many of your fellow residents recently, or former residents, that there's still the Tenderloin and other neighborhoods where a lot of poor people live, and you still have a big homeless population. So you do see the extremes, you know, right? And living in a city where you have those extremes, and which is also a very walkable/bikeable city, you know, you're seeing it all the time. And I guess I wonder if being a lawyer and a public defender, you know, if that marriage is something that, to what extent, you know, is the place you are informing the work that you do and how you got into it in the first place?
Well, it's such a hard question to answer because for me, getting into the art was probably more personal. It was, it was about an aesthetic inquiry mm-hmm. into trying to understand something that I had slowly grown to have, an affection for, some kind of interest in. For me, the political work was about trying to solve a problem. You know, I was a public defender working in the courtrooms, mm-hmm. and, the district attorney took positions that I saw people getting hurt by every week, mm-hmm. and so I basically ran for the position. I mean, I had no experience. I was never managed any people in any post. I was not a manager even in the public defender's office. And suddenly I was running for the top law enforcement job in the city, you know, one of the major cities in the United States. Mm-hmm. I didn't care that I wasn't allowed to do it any more than I didn't care that I wasn't allowed or supposed to be an artist at some point when I started doing that. But it was just like, I'm going to get out there and articulate why I think this doesn't make sense. And whether it was criminalizing marijuana or the three strikes law or not going after police brutality or not protecting against fraudulent evictions. You know, I started to articulate a program and the other candidates had to engage with that. And, you know, even if I didn't have the money to win or I didn't have the experience or the gravitas to win, you know, here was this little insurgent campaign that suddenly made everybody address issues that they probably would have avoided otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, although San Francisco was very progressive, and I'm talking 1999 at this point, I still remember going into Democratic clubs because I was a Democrat at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you were not taken serious as a candidate if you supported gay marriage and were against the death penalty.
Wow. There was in 1999?
Yeah, there was maybe one Democratic club, the Harvey Milk LGBT, Democratic club that would be okay at. The others pretty much thought, okay, well, you're not going to make it as
right.
a candidate. But they privately agreed. They were like, forget it, you don't have a chance.
Yeah. Well, was that insurgent, as you, the word you use, nature, something that informed your move towards the Green Party, or more specifically, getting together with Ralph Nader?
For sure, yeah. I mean, because, with time, I just saw parts of a political machine that was ostensibly from the same political party I was in trying to undermine any progressive effort in the party. It's kind of like what Bernie Sanders came up against, although obviously at a much smaller level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just like, you know what, I'm going this other route. And here's a party you get welcomed into. There are people trying to do, and they believe what you believe in. And it's like, why pretend anymore? Was kind of where I was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was a backlash to it initially. I mean, there were a lot of Democrats that were still upset with Nader in 2000 that
right.
blamed the outcome. And, it had its own difficulties, but the difficulties weren't inherent to the political party.
Yeah.
So I preferred that.
Right. Well, I at the risk of sort of taking the sort of popularity contest angle as opposed to the deeply political one, because I feel like you have been asked probably ad infinitum about what it was like to run with Ralph Nader, what it was like to, be in the mayor's race and lose a close race against Gavin Newsom, who became the mayor. That I just want to know, how that getting into the spotlight, what that was like,
as
a starting point.
Yeah, I mean, I got elected to the Board of Supervisors after I had run for district attorney, and I pretty much represented the most left-leaning district in the western United States. You know, it included the Haight-Ashbury,
mm-hmm.
and the Western Addition neighborhood, so it was pretty left-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
I ran for mayor, and I wasn't supposed to win that contest. People sort of forget that I wasn't supposed to do very well at all,
mm-hmm.
but I'd gotten into the race because the front runner was doing so well in articulating what I would say are conservative views within the San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
that I thought that there had to be a challenge to it,
right.
that could articulate what was wrong with the vision.
Right.
And in San Francisco, the left and right is not defined by where you fall on the social issues that I mentioned earlier, because mm-hmm. those eventually were adopted by the mainstream Democrats. But what it really turns on are the economic issues, what you think about development,
right.
things like raising wages, and that kind of, you know, those kinds of issues, public health, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I ran a spirited campaign, and I got very close to winning. So the outcome didn't affect me personally in the sense of being dispirited by not having won. It was more kind of like we were shocked that we were able to put it together and make it so competitive.
Right.
And if we had a regret, it was a regret that the Green Party didn't get to win this major race and show, you know, the country that Green could govern in a major city. And the repercussions of that would have been more Greens, you know, in political offices.
Right. Yeah, and that's, if I could just jump in, that
yeah.
actually reminds me of a very common complaint that you've probably heard as well of late, which in regarding the Green Party on the presidential level with Jill Stein, people are saying, you know, don't just run for the presidency every 4 years, you know, start at the local level.
Right.
Start at the local level, all over the place, you know. And so that's the complaint. Maybe you would disagree with that as a premise, but it sounds like in San Francisco that's been going on because of your involvement and others already.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, I do think that's a better strategy. But, you know, candidly, I joined the Green Party and ran for local office because of Ralph Nader's national run in 2000.
Right.
Where, while watching him, I realized, gee, I got more in common with this guy than the party I'm in.
Right.
But, you know, when Ralph, you know, obviously Ralph became, I don't even know if it's the right word. I mean, it's like a pariah to
mm-hmm.
the establishment. He ran in 2004 with Peter Camejo, who was a dear friend of mine and a Socialist Worker Party candidate for president in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter was dying of cancer. And in 2008, and I think kind of, you know, told Ralph he should pick me to run with him. And, you know, by this point, as much of an icon as Ralph Nader is, there weren't a lot of people that wanted to stand up with him because they just felt like they didn't want the wrong outcome in the election. And for me, when you're asked to do something like that, you know, it's like I really respect Ralph Nader, and Ralph is right about so many issues that I wouldn't have felt good about myself not to do what I could to help him.
Right.
And certainly I felt somewhat of a stand-in for Peter Camejo, who, you know, had always been a political mentor of mine.
Right.
And, but, you know, I mean, politics in this country, hopefully this last election helps people see that, you know, with Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, that, you know, we gotta fix how we do elections so that we can have more candidates rather than less.
Yeah.
Or maybe say it differently, so that you can cast the ballot for who you want without fearing
exactly.
getting somebody else elected.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I want to go back to what you referred to in describing raising awareness of Green Party values and issues, you know, when you ran, and, you know, it was a way of putting the green on the map in San Francisco because you had a different, you had a more of a economic barometer, right, for left and right in San Francisco. And because here we are, you know, with San Francisco being the crazy, overly gentrified and you know, tech transformed town that it is. Do you, all that to set up, do you feel that there are enough people on the right side of that as far as changing things, as far as development? I mean, certainly there are all kinds of provocative issues around development, including something that comes to mind that I remember seeing in a local LA paper, I believe, that was about the pro-development people of San Francisco because, you know, for reasons that in some ways sound logical, which is to provide housing to more people, but then you have, you know, where does it end?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a complicated issue, and I'm happy to give you an answer, but I want to preface it by just saying, you know, we could really talk about this issue for a very long time.
Right. It's the shortened version.
Yeah, I mean, there's these very delicate levers that get pulled at City Hall in terms of, you know, metaphorically for how they affect people's lives in the city, and everything from rent control to the percentage of inclusionary housing when you build a new development,
mm-hmm.
to whether or not you're going to collect a business tax or give somebody a business tax break,
mm-hmm.
should you have a payroll tax or a business tax based on gross receipts. You know, all these issues were kind of swirling around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the more I look at the situation today, the more I realize that we're going to have to come up with kind of regional solutions to a lot of the issues. Because I'll just give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we traditionally collect a business tax that is supposed to then offset the impact of workers being in a city, in part, like, you know, you're going to put that money into transportation, into parks, into schools, to run your government. But now, because people can live in a city and commute outside of the city to a job, let's say at Google or Facebook down the peninsula,
right?
We don't get to tax those companies because they're not in San Francisco, but we have their workers living in San Francisco, and so we get the impact but not the offset.
Right.
And the main reason that's happening is, you know, you can get on a bus provided by, you know, the company, and, you know, because of Wi-Fi or being connected, you can actually get work done as you commute.
Yeah.
Technology is kind of creating this new problem for us, and so those cities down the peninsula have tremendous wealth,
yeah,
but they don't actually have the people to spend it on, and that's something that regional government and state government has to tackle.
Yeah,
but there are a lot of issues like that. There are solutions, you know, and most of them are just, you know, you just see how things are interconnected and why, you know, why something, you know, typically if it doesn't make sense, you know, there's a reason for it.
Yeah. Well, let's take it to the more personal, just anecdotally. Yeah, we talked about this privately last time a little bit. You've lived in the city for years, and I believe you're in a rent-controlled place. So, you know, you're relatively immune to the market rate apartments. But my question is, what has been your perception just doing your regular meandering around the city with the change in demographic and, you know, a lot of wealthy tech people. Yeah.
Yeah, I do think the city is changing. I think, you know, a lot of people are just anecdotally, you know, a lot of folks have moved to LA where there's more opportunities and get studio space and housing is easier to come by. I always saw rent control as kind of the flip side of Proposition 13, mm-hmm. as it relates to property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Like a property owner can buy a house and then you set the property tax and they pay that tax and it can't go up as long as they live in the house. And the idea being that it was unfair to take maybe a retired elderly couple and price them out of their own home simply because real estate values had gone up.
Right.
And so with rent control, you know, the theory was, hey, you pay the rent, whatever the owner is asking, but once you're there, you know, you're only going to be subject to relatively small increases. And, you know, it'll go up a few hundred dollars over the years. But once you move out, the owner then takes back the property. It can ask whatever market price they want. You know, that owner of that building typically is setting the original rent values at a number that allows them to pay the mortgage on that building.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
while they may not be making all the return on you as a tenant, they're certainly gaining a tremendous amount of equity in the building.
Right.
And they're always, I mean, I live in a 12-unit building. They're always, every year somebody moves out and somebody new moves in. I mean, there's always some movement. And in that way, you don't create this situation where people can't afford to live in a place, or there's got to be, you know, some stability for renters as well. In San Francisco, rent control only applies to buildings built before, I think it's like the summer of 1979, which is also unfair because buildings built after that are not subject to rent control, which means the building owners for those older buildings are really shouldering the burden of what is in effect affordable housing for people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think rent control should be kind of spread out to all the constructions. That way, you know, the older buildings aren't the only ones. And of course, the older buildings are the ones that need more maintenance anyway.
Yeah.
When you said that
people move out once a year from your 12-unit building, if I remember right. So when somebody moves in, has the landlord raised the rent to market or above?
Yeah.
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 So the original
I moved into this apartment, you know, 9 years ago, and I remember almost not moving in because the rent was so high.
Mm-hmm,
it seemed above market.
Mm-hmm.
But I went for it, and of course now it's way lower than market rate. So,
yeah, yeah. So what I was wondering about that sort of anecdotal perception of the city is you have new neighbors both literally, you know, in your building and then broadly across the city. And so I was wondering, I mean, I could imagine a lifestyle in which, you know, you go to your job as the public defender, you go to your studio or, you know, you go to see fellow artists at their studios and you work at home and so on. And that sort of bubble, if you will, or that particular version of your life is going on. But then, you know, you're inevitably bumping up against a new set of neighbors. And so I was wondering if you noticed, some certain unpleasantness. I just had a conversation last week with one of your fellow artist residents who talked about that. He'd been in the Mission for years, you know, back in the early 90s when it was more of a bohemian locale and stayed it up until fairly recently and described that evolution. So what is your personal experience with those changes?
Yeah, I mean, I was in the Mission starting continuously, 91 until about 2000. So, that's my history as well.
Yeah.
On the personal level, interacting with individual, what we would call tech folks that have moved into the city, I haven't had bad experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a little bit of a feeling that folks don't really know the history of the city. They don't know some of the struggles and fights going on.
Yeah.
And, it does seem... And maybe this is just, a cliche or something, but it does feel like they're less committed to, some of the traditional values of San Francisco It's not to say that they're not, their politics aren't good or what have you, but there's going to be a greater lack of consideration, you know, for long-time residents.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I mean, I think it's you know, gentrification often comes about, and that's what, even in the Mission, I mean, it could be argued in the early 90s, you know, I was gentrifying the Mission when I first moved in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or others were. I mean, it was really gritty back then, but, you know, that could certainly be argued. But I don't know. There's a soft spot where it doesn't feel like you're, you know, when you're displacing other people, that's when it doesn't feel right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a very diplomatic answer, I just want to point out. But at the same time, I mean, I guess with the limited time since the tech takeover that I've spent briefly up there, I haven't experienced it firsthand. But I have heard about it and read about it quite a bit, and it definitely is something that really provokes ire. So, but I wanted to switch over to your work as public defender. Had a couple of questions. One just on perhaps a very superficial level. I presume that you spend a fair amount of time, if not maybe during trials, a lot of time in the courtrooms and, you know, the federal building or what have you. Or it's not a federal building, it's a state building?
We call it, like, it would be the county criminal court.
Okay, county criminal court.
State,
got it.
It's state courts, yeah.
Right, okay. All that to preface that my experience with those types of buildings and their interiors, you know, they're very old. They are not aesthetically very pleasing. And I just wonder, as now an aesthete yourself, you know, as an artist and an aesthete, if visually, you know, that can be being stuck in one of those buildings for, I don't know, 12 hours in some cases, if that can be a real drag.
It's a great question. I'm kind of laughing.
Good.
You know, I used to spend a lot of time in that building, and honestly, now I only handle a couple of big cases at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if I'm in the courthouse, it's either to watch another attorney do something, you know, that I'm kind of maybe helping or giving advice on, or if I'm going over there to negotiate kind of bigger problems, either with judges or, you know, the district attorney, upper brass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in San Francisco, there's an elected public defender. That position's held by a good friend of mine, Jeff Adachi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the chief attorney, which is the position right below his. And then, you know, there's about 190 plus lawyers in the office. So, you know, there's always something going on in the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we have pretty regular meetings with the district attorney and some of his main lieutenants or whatever we should call them,
mm-hmm.
where we try to, you know, formulate policies between the offices. You know, it's kind of like, it's not exactly a peace treaty type smoking encounter, but, you know, it has a certain vibe like that, where we're trying to keep the peace between the offices.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to your question, I mean, the building, the Hall of Justice in San Francisco is supposed to be rebuilt. So it is kind of run its course, and it is definitely everything that you're describing. I mean, it looks like an old Department of Motor Vehicles building or something, and out of the 60s. And, you know, I'm sure it was quite spectacular in its day, but it's hard to, you know, there's nothing modern about it.
Right. So all that to say that you have to hit the collage hard when you get home.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. So on a much more serious note, you are representing a man named Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez, who people will recognize by description, possibly, as the Mexican immigrant, quote unquote, that Trump has, I don't like to use his name, Orange Julius Caesar, I prefer, has referred to as often as case point for illegal immigration and why it's so wrong. So all that to set up, you know, and correct any of that if any of it's wrong, but all that to set up where that stands now that we do have this person in office and, you know, if that's changed the heat at all, the attention.
Well, I suspect that there'll be a lot of attention on the case when it goes to trial. This is it's a murder case where Lopez Sanchez is accused of killing Kate Steinle, and you know, Fox News and Bill O'Reilly and the president have all, you know, talked a lot about the case because she obviously it's a tragedy what happened to her, and you know, it kind of fit into the narrative that Trump wanted to put out there, which is this idea that, you know, Mexicans are coming to this country to commit crime. You know, Lopez Sanchez doesn't have any history of violence or weapons or stuff like that. And he has said in interviews that he found wrapped up in something this thing that turned out to be a gun and that discharged while he was handling it. We have been able to prove that the bullet that came out of that gun struck the concrete of the pier that all of this took place on and then traveled about, you know, 100 feet before striking Kate Steinle in the back and killing her. So, you know, candidly, I mean, I think we just want a fair trial. You know, we just want jurors to think about, like, hey, if they were on trial in another country, they would want the laws to apply to them and to be given fair treatment. If Lopez Sanchez was a, you know, Caucasian college kid, or if he was from, you know, England or Sweden or France, you know, he probably wouldn't be charged with this.
Right.
Because it's not a robbery. He doesn't know this person. He has no motive to do her any harm. And, you know, it is a really perplexing case, you know, just not, it doesn't make sense if you try to fit it into the narrative that Trump has.
Yeah.
The thing about Lopez Sanchez that I think a lot of people don't understand is that there's a federal law that applies to him because he suffered a conviction, I don't know, a couple of decades ago for what would technically be called drug trafficking, even though the sale of a very small amount of, I don't know if it was, I don't remember if it was marijuana or cocaine or heroin or something. It was a small amount. Probably didn't do, you know, more than a week in jail. But he was deported after that. So every time he comes into the country, it's treated as a special crime because drug trafficking is equated with other, quote-unquote, aggravated felonies like murder, rape, you know, molestation, explosives, all kinds of stuff. So every time he comes here looking for work, even if he doesn't commit another crime, he's facing a 20-year federal prison sentence. And so you'll hear them say that he has suffered four of these convictions. He's been to prison like four times, but it's for illegally reentering the country, having been deported for an aggravated felony. And instead of doing 20-year sentences, he plea bargains down to, you know, 5 years or the like. And so I think, you know, nobody's really talking about that aspect of a law that is pretty harsh on somebody. I mean, you could commit an armed robbery in San Francisco and you're not going to do a 20-year sentence. The thought that we've got thousands of Mexican nationals that were maybe busted with little minor drug cases serving all this prison time in federal prison, you know, is pretty alarming. And it would be nice if, you know, Congress addressed the issue. I think you know, I think it's fine to say you want to punish people in an aggravated felony situation more severely than just someone trying to come into the country that you've never deported before. But I don't think it's fair to equate the sale of a small amount of contraband with these crimes that are very, very serious, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a different thing if you got some truckload of, you know, controlled substance or who knows what, but we're talking, you know, very minor offenses.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, you referred to, you know, some Fox shows that were, you know, sort of repeating the commotion about it on their shows. And I just wondered if you have been, or especially when this case does go to trial, somebody sought by the media to be a talking head about the trial, or as a lawyer, if in most cases you're immune to that and you're not, you know, you're not permitted actually to speak at the most when a trial is over.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll make statements and answer questions during the pendency of the case, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to be careful not to try the case improperly in the media.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a case that's taken on a lot of interest, and, you know, most of the things are out there because Lopez Sanchez gave an interview to a TV crew, and literally you can still watch that on the internet. So
was that an unwise decision?
No, I mean it's actually, I think it really informs kind of what kind of person he is,
and
you hear it in his own voice. You know, the problem for me is I just hate to see a vulnerable person get kind of picked up to be used as a you know, football in this political game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so like Bill O'Reilly has been pushing this thing of Kate's Law, so that anybody who comes into the country after being deported would face a minimum of 5 years in prison. And this is Kate's Law. But the problem with that is Lopez Sanchez, it wouldn't even apply to him. Because every time he came into the country, he was facing 20 years, you know.
Mm.
So suddenly you see this whole legislation being built around a case that wouldn't even apply to the alleged, you know, perpetrator, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, we're in San Francisco, and, you know, I'm sure we'll have a jury that is familiar with the case. But, you know, what you're looking for is people, you know, who will keep an open mind and hear the evidence before they prejudge it.
Yeah. Right. Well, good luck with it whenever it does come to light.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
It was scheduled to happen in February, but because of the district attorney's schedule, she's expected to be in another trial. We pushed it back probably to April or May, and
mm-hmm.
so suddenly I had a little window of time, and I thought I should come see, you know, visit my family in Texas before that gets real hard to do.
Oh, I see. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I will let you get back to your visit. I hope it's a good one. And, Matt, it's been great talking. Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. I hope this sounds is acceptable. It was fun chatting with you.
It was, yeah.
I'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much again to Matt Gonzalez. His work and his writing is all linked through the website, theconversationpod.com, if you want to check out more. In the meantime, I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your support, you the listener's support, is what keeps this show going. And now there's a new way you can support the show. It's called Patreon, Patreon, where you can donate on an ongoing monthly basis for as little as a dollar a month even. Although if you donate a little higher level, you get more bonuses. So check out Patreon. It's linked through the website, or go to patreon.com and look up the Conversation Art Podcast. Of course, you can still donate via PayPal, which is also extremely appreciated. Your support of the show financially means a lot. I love getting those emails in the particular folder of the inbox saying, you have received a donation. So keep that in mind if you are so inclined. You can also become a fan and follower and supporter of the show non-financially. At Artist Podcast is the handle on Instagram, Twitter, and you can follow us, become a fan on Facebook. You can also help more people find the show, and best way to do that is spreading the word. Word of mouth is greatly appreciated, telling people you like the show. And you can leave a very great review on iTunes, which is linked through the Conversation Pod as well. And if you have criticisms, questions, requests for the show, I'm always open to those as well. One of the benefits of not being controversial is I don't get much in the way of complaints, nor do I get much in the way of feedback. So I guess the neutrality is some kind of weird bonus. But yeah, I love hearing from you. I'm quick to respond. So if you have something you want to share, some suggestions, some feedback, questions, feedback, you know where to go, theconversationpod.com, and you can email directly theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. One other thing before we go, you may have heard in the past I have talked about a new podcast that I have been in the works with, and that's been for a while now, and it's honestly stalled quite a bit because I really need help on a sort of intern producer level to organize the communication in regards to potential guests, among other things related to that. So if that is you, if you are interested in that by any chance, or you know somebody who might be, I would be incredibly grateful if you could pass that along. You can just reach me through that same email, and I'd love to tell you more about it. Oh yeah, and just to give you a little more information, it's about how people get by, and not at all necessarily artists, people doing anything, how they get by in a whole range of ways across a whole range of demographics. And when I've told people about it, they're like, oh yeah, I'd like to listen to a podcast about that. So there definitely seems to be advanced interest. So I'll tell you more about it, though. Get in touch with me. There is no money coming from it right now, so I can't pay anybody, but there is potential for pay as money built when the show is launched. So keep that in mind, but it could certainly be for academic credit. Hope that helps fill you in a little bit about that. And I'm grateful for you spreading the word on that as well. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I will talk to you next week. It's not San Francisco week per se, but it is partial San Francisco week. It's a recent refugee from San Francisco to Los Angeles, just to give you a preview. And it's a barnstormer, so stay tuned for that. Have a good one. Talk to you then. Ciao for now.